Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Later in the hour today, we're going to revisit our portion of our conversation with Senator Mazie Hirono from Hawaii, the first Asian American woman, the only immigrant currently serving in the U.S. Senate. Her memoir is Heart of Fire, an Immigrant Daughter's Story. It's an inspiring account of one woman coming into her personal and political power and a heartwarming homage to the women who raised her. But first, earlier this month, President Biden designated a new national monument, the Camp Hale Continental Divide National Monument in Colorado. And according to the Ute tribe, the new national monument is within the homelands of the Ute Indian tribe's Uncompahgre Band. The United States forced the Uncompahgre Band off those lands in 1880. Quoting the Ute tribe, "Today the United States was back to further dispossess the band from its lands by designating a monument without fully including the tribe." And so today we feature a conversation with Ute Tribe Business Committee Chairman and Uncompahgre Band Representative Sean Chapoose. I reached to Mr. Chapoose yesterday. Tell me a little bit about the Ute Tribe. I understand there are three bands.
Okay, so the Ute Tribe here, the Ute Indian Tribe, yeah, there's three bands. There's the White River Band, the Uncompahgre Band, and the Uinta Band. And so the two bands, the White River and Uncompahgre, originally were Colorado tribes. So they were removed out of Colorado and moved over here. The Uinta Band were the Utes on the Wasatch Front. So they were removed from the Wasatch Front and moved over here. So the three bands were relocated to this reservation.
This is, of course, you know, forcible relocation, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It wasn't, like, voluntarily.
Yeah.
We didn't volunteer to move. But, yeah, it was basically taking of the lands they were occupying and then saying, we're going to move you to the lands nobody wants. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much it in a nutshell.
So two of the bands from Colorado and the other band from the Wasatch area.
Yep.
Yeah. So what we're talking about right now is President Biden's creation. He's just recently announced this, of a new national monument, the Camp Hale Continental Divide National Monument. The Ute tribe is definitely opposing this, I understand.
Yeah, we oppose it. We oppose the process. So I'll give you a little history on it. So about a week before they'd done the actual designation, they had reached out to our tribe and told us that they were contemplating or discussing, you know, potentially creating this monument. The council went and told them that they couldn't comment on it yet because they didn't know enough about it to either agree or disagree. But the land that is located are the traditional lands, or the lands where the Uncompahgres and White Rivers lived. So we have interest in it. You know, that's one of the lands we were pushed out of. So time goes by. The following week, I get a notice from the White House saying, hey, we need the three chairmen of the three tribes to be out here because we're going to designate this monument. So I go out there. And basically, it's, for lack of words, a circus, right? And so I'm out there, and they're not sure what's going on. So I just told them, hey, I ain't going to be part of this. And relayed that back to the council. Then the council went and created the press release. I proofed everything, and then we sent it out. So we object to the process and the monument as far as how that process went. That's part of that discussion.
In your press release, you call that moving forward without consultation of the former homelands, peoples, you use the word genocide.
Yeah, and so I've had this discussion with a lot of people. So genocide is the extinction or the erasing of a group of people and their identity or their culture. So it's an ongoing genocide that continues, right? So in reality, it's as if we don't exist or didn't exist there. We're wiped off of the history book. And we have that same dilemma here where we're at in Utah. So, you know, I know people get offended by that conversation, but I mean, it is what it is. You know, if people look up the word, it is really the erasure or the elimination of a culture, its people, and identity. Hmm. And our identity is tied to them lands. You know, that's where we come from.
Tell me a little bit more about that. In fact, let me read from your press release. You say, surrounded by forests, mountains, and towns named after the tribe and its leaders, President Biden met with other tribes from the area, but did not include the Ute Indian tribe and the Uncompahgre Band, who sustained these lands long before the founding of the United States. So, you know, there are names there. There are graves there as well. I guess maybe that's a key factor.
Well, so if you was to take a map of the territory, so not like the state maps now, right? But if you was to take territorial maps, they identify where all the bands of Utes and other tribes were centrally located, their ranges, their homelands. And you'll see that all of that is, like I said, Uncompahgre and White River country. It's identified specific to those two bands. So when they go and talk to the Ute Mountain Ute and Southern Ute, you know, they have their territories and they have a right to comment on their side, but we're the actual Uncompahgres and White Rivers. So there's artifacts. And I mean, people go up there and build, they run into, you know, grave sites. It's littered with our remnants, let's put it that way. And then if somebody would pay attention, they tout how all the major highways in Colorado or roads and towns are the original Ute trails. So Utes were renowned for horsemanship. So they rode horses all through that country. And so where most of the horse trails were is now where their infrastructure has been put up. So all their roads going into their towns, there's national forests named after the bands. Where that one's located is actually called the White River National Forest. Then a little south of that is Uncompahgre National Forest. So, you know, they have our names written all over stuff out there.
Now, my understanding, there are some tribal leaders who were consulted on this. What do you say to that?
Well, yeah, and that's what I said earlier. So you had the Southern Ute and the Ute Mountain Ute. And there again, you know, that's nice they consulted with them. But we know the historical record that them particular lands and stuff were Uncompahgre and White River country. And we know that them two bands still exist. So that'd be like me going down into their section of town and trying to weigh in on their properties without really having a valid claim to it. So, you know, they were part of the discussion, because one of the comments we get a lot is, since we're not in Colorado no more, the governor or whatever down there has no obligation to talk to us, just to the tribe that's in their state. So,
you say in your press release that this is a violation of principles of nation to nation, and how federal to the Ute tribe should be handled.
Yeah. So even in that area, right? One of the mandates, especially when you're dealing with sovereigns, and that's a touchy term depending on who's commenting on it, right? But so our original agreements are not with states, but with the federal government. So in all these agreements, there's supposed to be a form of consultation, or at least a back and forth conversation to address concerns. So even though they can designate stuff, there's still laws that protect our rights, NAGPRA laws, cultural rights laws and stuff. And that's why you have consultation, so you can kind of filter through all of the problems that could arise. That way everybody's kind of on the same page if something does happen. And that's just one of the failures of all administrations. Their idea of consultation, in my point of view, is conversation. They more or less tell you something, but they don't want to hear the response coming back. Once they get their mind made up, they more or less just, then they check the box saying, well, we consulted with you, but that's not consultation.
What would you like to see happen here? Where are you going to be? Are you going to court with this?
No, we haven't made that determination. Mm-hmm. We haven't said if we were or weren't. But I want to raise to everybody the whole, the dilemma we face as Indian tribes, right? So part of the problem with this, so what I want to clarify too, so this particular incident wasn't like the fight that, to end all fights, it's a continuation of ongoing fights. It just come to a head. It's one of them situations where, you know, enough's enough. We're tired. We ain't going to proceed any further. And so we object. And so now that we're objecting, now they're like, well, what's the problem? So it's not all that monument. I know everybody would like it to be just that particular thing, but it's not. It's the whole relationship that exists between the federal government and the tribes, the agreements that were made, and the promises that were never kept. It just came to a head, more or less.
In your press release, you talk about ongoing, I guess, disputes, disagreements back in Utah, right?
Yeah. So go to this particular piece of land, right? And I think this will help people understand more what transpired. So imagine my band of Utes lived in Colorado, like I said, and the White Rivers. So they remove us from there, and they move us into Utah. They establish a reservation called the Uncompahgre Reservation on the south end of the Uinta Valley Reservation. The moment they got us here, they turned around and started taking the land back immediately. They opened it up for homesteads and a bunch of other stuff. So that transpires. Then in 1934, they have the Indian Reorganization Act. In the act, it says any lands that weren't homesteaded would be surplus, would be restored back to their original status as trust land or the reservation. They'd done that on the upper part, the Uinta Valley, but did not do it on the Uncompahgre part. So for years, we've been going to court with the state of Utah over jurisdiction and other things, specifically in the Uncompahgre. So we've got all these court rulings basically reaffirming that the reservation was never disestablished or diminished. And the BLM manages them lands, but we want them lands restored according to the actual law, the 1934 Indian Reorganization Act, which they did not fulfill. And that discussion's been going on as long as I've been in council. So we've been going back and forth with them over the same topic. And then just recently, you know, we filed lawsuits specific to this, also to water rights, because the land and the water are all tied together. And early on in the discussion, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago when Governor Herbert was still the governor. So we had initiated legal action against the trustee or the federal government. State of Utah decided they want to intervene, and we tried to remind them that, you know, we're not fighting with you, we're fighting with the federal government. And then next thing you know, we're fighting with the state. And so it's kind of like just been an ongoing battle over these lands, the resource, and, you know, we're just wanting them to honor the commitment they made. Because there again, if you're going to take me out of one piece of land, move me to this one, then turn around and take this one from me, well, you know, give me my first one back. So that's kind of where this is going, back and forth, back and forth.
What can you envision a form that a resolution might take? What would need to happen for these things to be resolved?
One of the things we asked for was just the federal government to actually address the question. See, because what they're doing is they're dodging it, right? So they're keen on creating a monument and getting us as tribal leaders in the room, but they like to ignore real life issues. And that's one of our complaints is, you know, it's nice that you can take time out of your so-called busy schedule to do this, but what about these ongoing things that you're aware of and it's under your control, yet you're turning a deaf eye to it? But you want us to come gather and take a little picture of us and say you're saving the day when we've got these ongoing issues that need to be resolved for all of us, not just for us as a tribe, but for the state, for local people. You know, as long as you have this dispute going, it's just going to be contentious, which it has been for the last, 50, 60 years.
Mm. I believe one thing you're calling for is congressional hearings, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because it goes back to the whole consultation process. So one of the things that we point out is the United Nations declaration about what consultation is, free and informed prior consent, which was adopted, right? And we want them to actually adhere to their commitments as far as consultation. And so the only way you're going to get that is you're going to have to get Congress to hear it. And because they are the arm of the government that creates the laws, which then go up and get signed into law. And so, yeah, we want everybody to know that our grievance isn't that we're just mad, you know, because that's the painting that is portrayed of us, is it's, oh, they're just upset, you know, oh, we give them everything. Well, that's not the case. The problem is there were commitments made. There were treaties signed. There were takings of lands. There's all these things that transpired to create where we're at. We've been doing what we were asked to do. they are failing to do what they promised to do. And, you know, you get to a point where it's like, when do you just let it continue? Because if, take the situation I'm in, if my original homeland's in Colorado, I've been displaced, then I get put over here in my new homeland, and they're going to displace me, where do I go after that? And then go back to what I said, genocide, right? So if you don't want me to exist, you know, is this the plan? Take my land here, take my identities, my culture, move me here, tell me this is your new home, make a good life of it, and as I attempt it, oh, but I'm going to take that away from you also. And then eventually, what, we're just a page in the history book?
Anything else you'd like to say about this?
I think one of the things that I've tried to relay to everybody that's asked me this question is, I think the average individual, right, the average citizen, sometimes gets caught up in thinking that this is directed towards them. I want people to understand it's not. This isn't me fighting with the person on the street. Who I'm fighting with is the federal government and the state bureaucracy about, you know, all these commitments and promises. You know, there comes a point where if you're not going to follow, then you're breaching your agreements, then at least give me back what I want or what was mine. Because I think Indian country and my tribe in general, right, we've played along with this for a long time. Because here in Utah, you know, I think people don't realize is the water on the Wasatch Front comes off our reservations. The oil and gas activity comes off our reservations. You know, we provide a lot to the surrounding communities and to the state. And we've always tried to tell them, you know, leave us alone, we leave you alone, and we can work together. But for some reason, it's just turned into, no, we want what you got. And we will use our political power, our connections at the federal level to whittle away at you. And, you know, people that read the newspaper seen there's a fiasco going on over Tabby Mountain. You know, people forget we're engaged in that rumble. You know, one minute it's up for sale, we make a bid, next thing you know, oh, it's not for sale, you know. So you've had this long history of takings. And in our particular tribe's situation, the taking's been at our expense. All the national forests were once tribal lands taken. You know, water's been taken. Lands are taken. And the taking just never stops. And so I would like people to understand, you know, like I said, that I'm not fighting against the individual. I got no problem against him. He has no authority or power to say anything. But I do believe that the bureaucracy has created more chaos for all of us, and they need to answer for it. They need to tell the truth, be truthful about it at least, you know, and be truthful with us, and quit painting the picture like, oh, they're just upset, you know, they're not getting what they want. It's like, I'm not getting what I want, is I'm not getting what you gave me when you took the other stuff from me, is my problem.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Ute Tribe Business Committee Chairman and Uncompahgre Band Representative Sean Chappuse. I appreciate you taking time with us.
Yeah, you have a good day.
Okay, you too. Appreciate it.
All right,
thanks.
Bye.
Bye now. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We reached Sean Chappuse yesterday on this timely topic. After a break, we're going to revisit a portion of our conversation with Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono. Her very interesting memoir called Heart of Fire, An Immigrant Daughter's Story. And we'll have that following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We were able to reach Senator Mazie Hirono from Hawaii last year, I believe it was earlier in the year, to talk about her memoir, Heart of Fire, An Immigrant Daughter's Story. Senator Hirono is the first Asian-American woman and only immigrant currently serving the U.S. Senate. And Heart of Fire is an inspiring account of one woman coming into her personal and political power and a heartwarming homage to the women who raised her. So we'll hear a portion next from our conversation with Mazie Hirono. So what inspired you to write this book?
My husband had been suggesting that I write a memoir, and I finally decided that my mother, who had suffered two strokes, no longer able to tell her incredible story, I wanted to do this and dedicate the book to her. And so I that was the impetus, really, for this book. I had, she passed away last month. I had an amazing mother who changed my life by bringing me to this country. And I wanted to do this to tell her story. And that of my grandmother also, who was a very amazing person herself.
In fact, the subtitle is An Immigrant Daughter's Story. Tell me about that. This is just incredible. Your mother came essentially alone with you and one of your brothers. So first of all, why did she leave Japan?
My mother escaped, literally, from an abusive husband and his abusive family, and brought her children. And she had to do it by stealth, because if he had found out, he would have stopped her, certainly from bringing us. But my mother changed my life by bringing us to this country, escaping an abusive marriage to a father who, to her husband, to my father who I never got to know. And so I didn't know anything about Hawaii and America. My goodness. I was raised on a little rice farm in rural Japan. And so this was a total, total change. I spoke no English or anything. And we were poor. And beginning in the beginning in Hawaii, my mother worked really hard with no such thing as a safety, a social safety net or anything. She worked hard with little pay, no health care, no benefits to take care of us. And she brought the two older kids, me and my older brother, because we would be old enough to go to school. And she had to make the really tough decision to leave my younger brother, Wayne, in Japan, because there would be nobody in Hawaii to take care of him while she worked.
And your mother, I think, worked two jobs, low pay each, to keep you guys afloat.
Yes, yes. So she worked for a Japanese language newspaper as a typesetter, and that was not anything she ever did in Japan. But she is a very focused, determined person, and she learned how to do it, and the pay was low. So she took a second job with a catering company, and she would do these evening catering jobs. So she was working most of the time. My older brother and I, we got our English names. She decided we should have English names. So she named me Maisie, and she named my older brother Roy. And while we were at it, she named my younger brother Wade. So we were original latchkey kids, I have to say, while my mother worked.
The book is called Heart of Fire. What are you talking about there?
It is a description of my mother, who had a heart of fire, because it takes tremendous courage and risk-taking to bring eventually three children and her grandparents to America so that we could get away from my father and start a new life for ourselves. But little did we know that that I would get into politics, or all of that is in the future. So my own journey was very, how shall I say, is unpredictable, I would say. But my mother was very, very supportive of all of the different things that I did, which were not the usual kinds of things that a young girl did. But it really expanded my horizons. And I had a mother who didn't, not once, say, when are you going to get married and when are you going to have kids? That took a lot of pressure off me.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier your grandmother, who apparently had the same spirit.
Yes, she did. She came to this country as a picture bride. And she married my grandfather, basically sight unseen, and my grandfather had come to Hawaii to work on the plantations at only age 16, so he didn't have much formal education. And then my grandmother decided that she would come here as a picture bride, and so she left everything she knew. She had a comfortable life in Japan, but I think she thought this would be a good thing for her, and she came to Hawaii and worked really hard on the plantations. You can imagine what life was like for her, and she determined that she would start a business. So she was quite entrepreneurial. They started a bathhouse, moving away from the plantation to downtown Honolulu. Then she also began to send money back to Japan because she fully intended to go back to Japan. A lot of the immigrant laborers who came to Hawaii intended to go back, and not many of them could because they didn't have enough money. But my grandmother being the entrepreneur business person that she was, so she takes my mother, who was born in Hawaii at age 15, to Japan, a place that my mother was not familiar with. So my grandmother took her children to a country that they didn't know, and then my mother brought me to a country that I didn't know. So it's quite the journey for our family to start life over three times, first in Hawaii, then back to Japan, then back to Hawaii.
What was it like growing up in Hawaii? This is a very diverse place.
Yes, thankfully. And I am even more thankful of that diversity and the fact that we appreciate the other cultures and we intermarry at a higher rate than just probably any other state. And so very diverse. I didn't know it then. All I knew was that this was a really nice place, but it wasn't Japan. And I miss my grandmother a lot because she raised me in Japan from the time I was three to just before I came. So I lived with her for 5 years, and there was a time when I knew her better than I knew my own mother. So it was quite the adventure. But you know, the focus was really on acculturating us. I was discouraged from speaking Japanese, and the whole idea was to fit in to this new country. So there was a lot of time spent doing that, and not to mention my mother working all the time. So I knew that we were poor and we were struggling, and that informs a lot of the kinds of priorities that I have in my political life. That kind of background.
Yeah, I want to talk about your background, how it fits with some of the legislation that you support. Maybe we talk about health care. You mentioned there certainly wasn't any social safety net for at least at that point for your mother and you.
So, Growing up, and my mother had very low-paying jobs with no health care, no benefits, and so I was really scared as a child. Mom would get sick, and she wouldn't be able to go to work. No work, no pay, no food. Even when she was working, we would run out of food by the end of the month, and so we lived really simply, ate really simply in a one-room boarding house for the first 2 years of our time, and so all of that. And then my grandparents were sponsored and we were able to reunite as a family, but it was still very much a humble beginning. We would move every 2 years. I kept changing schools every 2 years. I'd have to make new friends. I learned to pretty much be quite self-sufficient because we would move every 2 years. My mother kept trying to improve our living situation. I really thought, though, that in spite of the very unique background, I didn't really talk about the fact that I was an immigrant. People in Hawaii didn't know that I was an immigrant until I started running for office, basically. And there was a lot of my immigrant life that they didn't know what it was like growing up in Japan, what it was like coming to Hawaii. But it was literally that kind of background, my desire to do something that would give back to a country that gave me opportunities I never would have had in Japan. I definitely never would have been able to go to college. I definitely would not be running for office or doing that. I was raised on a little rice farm with my grandparents in a rural part of Japan. And so going to the university also really opened my eyes to protesting the Vietnam War. And that's eventually what was my political awakening, to finally begin to question what my own country was doing in Vietnam, and meeting some activist people who turned to politics as a way to make social changes. And I still believe that. And I ran my first campaign of a guy in 1970. Took me another 10 years of being really involved in politics in Hawaii before I ran for office myself, which is a pretty typical kind of trajectory for women in our country, in my generation. There were low expectations, people telling me, you can't do it, you're not ready, all of that. So that's something that I think a lot of women in this country can relate to. And clearly the culture that I come from, being vocal, confrontational, aggressive, we're not rewarded, particularly coming from a woman. So it was a trajectory and a journey for me to become this relatively outspoken person that I am now.
Certainly. I want to double back and talk about this gender gap, at least that was. And I don't know if it still is. So a man might go more directly, maybe run a campaign, then go directly to running for office. A woman, at least at that time, would, hesitate, and maybe for years, to run for office.
Yes. A lot of women thought that we weren't ready, we didn't have enough experience, et cetera. So, those are conditions that don't seem to stop the guys at all. As one of my staff people said, yeah, guys think that it's their God-given right to run for office. So for women, the preparation time is usually longer, certainly was in my case. The good thing is that there are a lot of young women in particular and minorities who are running for office, and they're doing it and getting elected. I am very reassured by that kind of activism. But for myself, it took me a while to be the candidate myself. By that time, I had worked on 3 campaigns, all for men. And but even then, I decided that I only had a bachelor's degree and I needed more credentials if I was going to be as effective as I wanted to be in the political arena. But I still wasn't thinking of running for office myself. So off I went to law school. And I had been out of college for 5 years. So it was kind of interesting to be one of the older law students. But it was a good thing because in law school, I was not on this treadmill that so many of my law school the fellow students were. They were on a treadmill to get these big deal, go to these big law firms and all that. And that was never a goal that I had. My goal was to get that credential so that I could go back to Hawaii and start a public interest law firm or join a public interest law firm. There weren't any such law firm, so I joined the Attorney General's office. That came close, mm-hmm. to public interest law.
Right. You mentioned this journey from, holding back, not being outspoken, to becoming outspoken. again, that's that's socialization, right? That the girls are taught, at least, I don't know if it's now, but at least at the time, you don't speak out.
Alyssa, you mentioned the gender gap, and it still is. Believe me, there's still views about, for example, Asian women, how we're supposed to be quiet and cooperative, demure, and all that. And clearly, if you recall, the Hillary's campaign against Trump, that's recent. I mean, look at the misogyny that she had to put up with, and clearly in the 2008 campaign that Hillary was in, there's just so much gender discrimination against her, and it's just amazing when I reread some of the books of that race, like Rebecca Traister's book on Hillary's 2008 race, and then to realize that women get asked questions like, is she likable enough? Do you think men are asked such questions? No. So the gender gap still exists. Thankfully, we have a lot of very articulate women who ran for office, got elected, and I think that is that kind of view of leadership from women is changing. And women are much more collaborative. I like to do things collaboratively, but if I have to, I will be very vocal and aggressive about it, mm-hmm. these days.
Yeah. You are, I believe, at this point, the only immigrant as a senator, right? And you talked a little bit earlier in our conversation about what it meant for you to be an immigrant, to come to America. I wonder if you could expand on that a bit. You talked about opportunities you had here that you would not have had back in Japan.
Our country still calls to people from all over the world who see our country as really a land of opportunity. And these are not just empty words to immigrants who come to our country in the hopes of creating a better life. And that was my experience. And yes, there are a lot of immigrants who come to our country who have great jobs and, who have all of that going for them. But for a lot of immigrants, they have the kind of experience in this country that I had. And so, yes, comprehensive immigration reform is a priority of mine. Speaking up for children who were taken away from their parents and the trauma that our country caused them with that, and my own experience of my younger brother having been left in Hawaii, I mean in Japan, when the rest of us came to Hawaii because he was too young to go to school, and the trauma that stayed with them, that trauma of separation, is something that I experienced. The lack of health care as an immigrant, poor paying jobs, that's also informs my wanting better pay for people, and you know, to create opportunities for people in this country. That's really important to me. So I would not be doing what I'm doing. I doubt very much that I would have run for office if I did not have the immigrant experience of coming to a whole new country, having to fend and watching my mom struggle, and doing things that were different from what the rest of my classmates were doing, such as, you know, working in a poor community and learning from that community that there was so much more to what I could think about doing with my life. So all of these things led to my running for office myself, but it was very strange to become the candidate and not the one supporting other candidates, all men, at that point.
Just a couple of minutes left here. I want to bring the conversation back to your mother. I just want to quote you. You say, "I watched my mom work incredibly hard, even when things were challenging or unfair, to provide a life for my brothers and me." The words that come to my mind are grit, resilience, traits that we all need these days. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about your mother and having these traits.
My mother, as I say, it was amazing that she took control over her life when women in Japan, she was only 30. She told me at one point that she had to do all this by the time she was 30, otherwise she didn't think that she could do it. So courage that she had as a young woman to literally put thousands of miles between my father and us, that's risk-taking. So the life lessons that I, much of which I learned from her, is one person can make a difference, because she made a difference. She changed my life with her courage and grit, perseverance. Two is half the battle is showing up. She just kept going, showing up, not just physically, but just mentally and emotionally staying the course. And she showed me that. And the third is to take risks, to get out of your comfort zone. And she certainly did that. Every time we moved, for example, to a better house, you know, we would have to pay more in rent, and everyone would be very concerned whether we could make rent. But she's a risk taker. She learned how to drive when she was in her 40s. She decided, okay, I'm going to learn how to drive now. And she drove until into her 80s. And she was totally active in everything she did, just focused on everything she did. She showed me the perseverance. So that is the heart of fire that she had. And she wasn't noisy about it. She wasn't beating her chest saying, look at me. No, she just went about doing things. Where she learned how to be a proofreader. I mean, here's a person who didn't even graduate from high school, and she goes to work for the newspaper to become a proofreader. And she became, I would say, the best, because she really took that job to heart, and she created her own workbook, all of that, and so pretty darn amazing that. She did all these things, and that's why I've told her, there is absolutely nothing I can do in my life, Mom, that could even compare to what you did. That's her legacy to me.
Well, we're out of time here. Thank you so much for telling us about your mother and about your story. The memoir is called Heart of Fire, subtitled An Immigrant Daughter's Story, and the author is Senator Mazie Hirono. Senator Hirono, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tom. You take care.
Okay.
Be kind.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Aloha.
Appreciate it. Aloha.
And bye.
Bye now. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're going to take a break, and then, as we always do on Thursdays, we'll feature Leo T. and Skywatcher. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We go out usually on Thursdays with Leo T. and Skywatcher. We'll go to him next. And we have a little bit of extra time today, so we'll fill out the program with the latest episode of Eating the Past as well.
It's many cultures, one sky. Skywatcher Leo T. here as we look up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space. Astronaut James McDivitt didn't get too lost, though. He commanded Apollo 9, and he has slipped the surly bonds of Earth and danced the skies on laughter-silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed and joined the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds. That's from a poem penned by pilot John McGee in 1941 called High Flight. James McDivitt and the crew of Apollo 9 tested the first complete set of command module and lunar module to go to the moon. He died Thursday in Tucson at 93. Along with David Scott, Russell Swigert, they were the follow-up to Apollo 8, which went to the moon and orbited without a lunar module. Apollo 9 tested the lunar module in Earth orbit extensively, as well as all of the Apollo systems, and were a ground or space-breaking flight, I should say, that paved the way to land on the moon with Apollo 11. McDivitt was also the commander of 1965's Gemini 4 mission, where his friend and colleague Ed White made the first U.S. spacewalk. Oh, have you seen the photos? They're historic photos of White during the spacewalk, became iconic images of White dangling against the command module with his umbilical cord against a beautiful background of the blue, blue Earth with very white, swirly clouds. And on his first flight in 1965, McDivitt reported seeing something out there. Something about the shape of a beer can flying outside the Gemini spaceship. People called it a UFO, and McDivitt would later joke that he became a world-renowned UFO expert. And speaking of spaceships to the moon, Artemis 1, the latest attempt to go back to the moon. The uncrewed orbital mission has seen delays from hurricanes and other snags, and they're ironing those out. As is the case for a first-time liftoff, it's still a test flight. The latest date is November 14, and if all goes well, Artemis 1 and the STS spaceship will rocket around the moon and back to Earth to thoroughly test its system before flights with astronauts. This one's going to take a while, 25 days. Heading further out into the solar system and celebrating the 25th anniversary is Cassini. Cassini was the first mission to orbit Saturn to land on the outer solar system and sample an extraterrestrial ocean. October 15th was the 25th anniversary of the Cassini launch, a joint endeavor of NASA, the European Space Agency, and the Italian Space Agency. I didn't know the Italians had a space agency. Cassini spacecraft was a keystone of exploration of the Saturn system and of gaseous planets in our solar system. Some great pictures it took, too. And as we delve into space exploration, taking the little Skywatcher spaceship out to join OSIRIS-REx, NASA's asteroid sampling mission that went way, way out in the solar system and landed on asteroid Bennu and took a scoop of the soil and rocks, fired its thrusters and left for Earth in May of 2021, and has just fired them again a few days ago for 30 seconds, a course correction to come back to Earth, and a complicated drop-off of the sample in Utah, the West Desert, via parachute. Utah State University's Space Dynamics Lab designed and built the camera electronics for a three-camera suite on board OSIRIS-REx. The spacecraft returns the sample in September of 2023. In the sky tonight, it's all of our heritage. And as we do a little space exploration of our own, finding a dark spot in the trees near a lake or the ocean or the terracotta of the Moab Rim. On Monday, Mars was shining bright on the line between the horn tips of the stars of Taurus. Tonight, look east once Mars is well up around 10 or 11 p.m., and Mars is still near the mysterious flock of geese-looking constellation, or, of course, the Bull. And big, bright, orange Aldebaran and a couple of intriguing double stars make a very interesting V-shape. And into the dark, pre-dawn sky, a moonless Friday morning, offering a good chance to catch some meteors. The meteors of the Orionid meteor shower, debris from Halley's or Halley's or Halley's comet. The shower's origin point, or radiant, will be highest in the hour before the first sign of dawn. So this is when the shower will appear most active. You might see 5 to 20 meteors per hour, and a few catch a little flame as they enter the atmosphere. That's fun to see. The best direction to watch is your darkest direction, probably overhead. The radiant is in Orion's Club under the feet of Gemini. That's where the meteors will appear to be directed away from, but you can pretty much look at the sky and you'll see them. The shower will be less active for a morning or two before and after this, but we'll still see them into the weekend. So look up, look around, and get lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T. on UPR, with translator station statewide and streaming live at upr.org.
Welcome to Utah Public Radio's Eating the Past and Other Tasty Morsels, a show that explores all things food.
Your hosts are Jeannie Sir, Jamie Sanders, and Tammy Proctor, all from the History Department at Utah State University.
Hello, this is Jeannie Sir, and today on Eating the Past, we will be exploring the state of Alaska. As Eating the Past is journeying through the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and D.C., there's some states that we each have personal connections to. For me, Alaska is one of those such states. I lived in Alaska in my childhood, in central Alaska near Fairbanks, and then spent summers with my family fishing and clamming near the coast of Valdez. The last frontier, they say about Alaska, and the wildness and expansiveness is what sticks with me still to this day. It is fitting that with Alaska, we discuss the wild and natural process of bread making sourdough. Sourdough is a bread that is made with a fermentation of wild yeast. According to the article, History and Domestication of Saccharomyces cerevisiae in Bread Making, the yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, also called brewer's yeast, is what has been instrumental to the fermentation of foods for millennia. The earliest known record of yeasted risen bread is from Egypt, from approximately 1300 to 1500 BCE. But of course, the process has been around for much longer. It has been argued that the fermentation of breads and fruit for alcohol has been around before the advent of agriculture. Recent evidence suggests that brewer's yeast originated in China before moving west via the route that is now known as the Silk Road. There's a rich history of bread making in Asia and Africa, as well as the West, each slightly different. But focusing for a moment on the West, the first commercial yeast is dated to the 1700s. Prior to commercial yeast, the most common form of yeast for breads, at least in the West, was foamy yeast, dredge waste from beer fermentations, sold directly from breweries. But then why sourdough in Alaska? The origins of sourdough in Alaska is usually traced back to the era of the Gold Rush. And a tidbit I did not know is that sourdough is also a term that refers to Alaskans that have survived several hard winters, or even a lifetime of winters. But the term sourdough most likely also came about during the same period of the Gold Rush, to the prospectors and settlers that then became Alaskans and brought with them a way of making bread that sustained them even when there were scarce resources. To anyone who has made sourdough and kept a sourdough starter, this process is akin to magic. The wild yeast comes from wherever the sourdough starter has been. It comes from the air, the individuals who have been near it, the flour, and a myriad of things. And since the wild yeast is from unique living organisms, sourdough starters get handed down and passed from person to person and generation to generation like a living history. I can't attest to how unique each sourdough is, but as someone who has dabbled in sourdough, all of my starters I have started from scratch. So you might also wonder why all this episode focuses on starter when the topic today is sourdough. Well, honestly, until I made bread from wild yeast, I never thought about the yeast. But of course, a reliable starter is crucial to the making of sourdough. So if you'd like to give it a try, here are a few tips. Rye bread is the most reliable flour for a sourdough starter. Rye has less gluten and more of the microbes that the yeast likes to feed on. Also, having a kitchen scale is crucial. It is best to measure the flour and water by weight with a 1-to-1 ratio of equal parts water and flour. But of course, each starter is unique, so it might not be true for your home. Also, while I have not tried it myself, you can add pineapple juice in the beginning to give your starter a good kick. After a few days, you can switch back to water. And lastly, it's patience. No matter what I do, my starters have taken 2 weeks before it's robust enough for bread. Yours might take longer, but eventually the yeast will colonize, and then you can dive into the myriad of ways to use your starter. Not only breads, but pancakes, pizza, buns, rolls, and all things delicious. Thank you for joining us today on Eating the Past. Please tune in next week as we journey to another state.
Support for UPR's Eating the Past comes from Rock Hill Creamery in Richmond, creating natural rind raw milk cheeses, including Dark or Snow Canyon Edam, named after two southern Utah canyons. Cheese with character. RockHillCheese.com and USU Dining Services, available to students and the community at 16 locations across the USU campus. More information at usu.edu/dining.